Welcome to Speaking in Maine here on MPBN Radio. Today we visit the campus of Colby College in Waterville for a speech by Doris Buffett, founder and president of the Sunshine Lady Foundation. Ms. Buffett spoke at Colby's recent nonprofit leadership conference. She is introduced by L. Sandy Mazel, director of the Goldfarb Center for Public Affairs and Civic Engagement, and William R. Kennan, Professor of Government at Colby College.
Doris Buffett has been described by her brother Warren as a retail philanthropist, in contrast to his own wholesale philanthropy, exemplified, of course, by his incredible gift to the Gates Foundation. Her retail philanthropy and that of the Sunshine Lady Foundation means that she knows the programs that she is funding well, and she considers each grant carefully. Each grant is an investment, and the decision to fund a program is always based on expected successful returns. Reflecting this approach, an article in Worth magazine called the Sunshine Lady Foundation, and I'm quoting here, uniquely hands-on, folksy, a person-to-person enterprise, the UN Foundation, because of Doris's hands-on personal involvement with every aspect of the foundation's grant writing process. In my mind, her approach stands as a model for other philanthropists to follow, one adopted by many of you in this room, members of Maine's philanthropic community, committed and passionate citizens of the state of Maine who are doers and workers as well as contributors. And it is an approach that we at Colby try to engender in our students. We have just received official word today, in fact, that we have been awarded a Sunshine Lady Foundation grant as part of SLF's Learning by Giving program. Next spring, my friend and colleague, Tom Morioni, the Charles A. Dana Professor of Sociology, will be offering a course which we hope will be tied to next year's annual meeting of the Maine Association. Learning by Giving, nonprofit organizations and philanthropy will be a civic engagement students, learning not only how nonprofit organizations work, but also how funders make important decisions. As part of the job of that students in that course, they will develop RFPs with appropriate criteria carefully spelled out. They will solicit proposals, and then the most difficult job of all, they will review the proposals that I'm sure many of you in this room will submit and decide who should be funded, based, by the way, on whether they view your proposals as investments that are likely to succeed. Doris Buffett's philanthropy, not only is funding the course that we are offering, but also, and more important in my view, her brand of philosophy has inspired the course, as it has done similar courses throughout the nation, and as I think it has done for the work of many of you here in this room. Please join me in giving a great welcome to Doris Buffett.
Well, I'm going to let you in on a little funny secret. I have already given this speech. I gave it about an hour ago in the room adjoining. I've been working really hard in the last week or so, and so I left it up to Mitty Beal, who's sitting here in the pink, and she's the brains of the outfit. And she said, you're going to be introduced by the governor's wife, and then you're supposed to talk for 20 minutes. And I don't know, I thought she introduced me. I talked for 20 minutes. So those of you who are in that room, just you can switch off and think happy thoughts because you heard it all. I was so chagrined. But at any rate, here we are. I'll start off by telling you that some time ago, my brother forwarded me a letter he'd received. It was from a man who knew that Warren had been it was a question of whether he had colon cancer or not at that time, and of course we were all terribly concerned, and it turned out no, he didn't, and he got well in a hurry, and he went right back to the office, which is where he belongs. And this man wrote him a letter and said, I wish I'd brought it with me, but I think I know it pretty well. He said, Dear Mr. Buffett, I am so happy to hear that you're convalescing and you don't have cancer. We need you in this world, and He said, but you know what you should be doing. And he said, you should be doing what your sister's doing. Which I love. Now, it sort of broke down after that because he said, one thing you should be doing is sending me that $60 million I asked you for. So so there was sort of a sour note there. But actually, yeah, that is true. I am a retail philanthropist, and I love the job. I don't think I could be doing anything in the world that would match this. I gave up all chances to be a movie star when I was emulating Shirley Temple. But since then, I've never had a calling for that, and I love what I'm doing. And it's the hardest work I've ever done in my life. And I should be taking it easy now, but I wouldn't give it up for anything. I have assembled the greatest staff that's possible. And when I say assembled, I just mean they sort of fell in. We operate on, they're not getting paid handsomely. We operate on 6%, maybe occasionally 10, but most of the time it's 6% overhead. And our job is to get that money out there and get it working. And so that's what we're doing about 7 days of a week. Our board members are assigned a job, I mean a big job, and of course they do not get paid. I would never look at a proposal where the board members are being paid. And that, believe it or not, that's something that does happen. So not for ours. I take them to a spa, an inexpensive spa, once a year, and they love it. And I want to stress right now that I don't know whether you agree with me, but the philanthropists I've met in large are very somber people. And I mean, no kidding, there's never a smile anywhere. And so we like to say, and this is true, we take what we're doing extremely seriously. We take ourselves not seriously at all. So we have fun, and that makes it a joyful place and a joyful time whenever we get together. We'll tell you about our parties sometime, not now. Now, we've gone through a number of stages, and we are now where we're going to be forever, and that's education. Because it's clear to us, you can't rise from one economic class to the next unless you know what you're doing. You have to be needed by somebody to retain your job, as we all know. You have to be irreplaceable. So that's what we do. We started with the usual things, sending kids to camps and building a Boys and Girls Club. That's when I was living in Morehead City, North Carolina. And then I offered the Giving Foundation $1 million for scholarships. You're not going to believe this, but they thought it over for a couple of months, and then they came back, and I said, there are two things we have to have. We have to have a letter of, what is that, where you note conflicting interests. And furthermore, we need to have an audit every year, which I believe is, you know, understandable. And I'll never forget this. One woman said, well, perhaps we can have that letter of non-whatever it is, but not for 25 years. Not now. And I thought, wait, what's the logic behind that? I think the logic was that they were giving scholarships to their relatives is what it was. And then my second thought was, pardon my language here, but if they're that dumb, I really don't want to entrust them with $1 million. So I had a one employee at that time, and Mariana, I got together, and we decided we could do better than that. So it was late in the season, so we were hard put to get any recruits for our scholarships. But she found a Business and Women's Professional Club or something, and they gave out scholarships, like maybe $500, and she got the list of the losers. We started with the losers. We had 14 losers that we gave scholarships to. And they did very, very well. And one went to New York University Law School, which was quite an achievement for a little girl from Morehead City, North Carolina. Well, we've continued on with that scholarship program. And we have they have to meet some pretty tough standards. All grandmothers love what we put in this requirement. They can't smoke, drink, pierce anything other than their ears. They can't have tattoos. They just can't have any fun at all, you know. You understand our motivation. They don't as well. But anyhow, they're very good about it. We've only had to let one or two go, and we have the highest retention rate, I think, of any scholarship program in the country. You set the bar high enough, and they'll reach it. and too often it's just lying on the ground. And they're proud of themselves. They're Sunshine Scholarship. And that's been a great pleasure, because these kids have gone on to do things they would never do if they hadn't gone to college and had lived only in Morehead City, North Carolina. So that was very successful. The next thing we did, this is how we sort of funneled our trajectory, then kept going on to more and more education. We had the idea of awarding workers in the battered women's people that work in that way, and rewarding them with, well, actually it was $10,000 and a Steuben dove piece, and a dinner and a trip to North Carolina, to Wilmington, North Carolina, Queen for a Day stuff. And so we put out the word, and we had lots and lots of nominations. One of them came from Natchez, Mississippi, where a woman named Gail Healy was nominated by her staff at a safe house, and they were explaining that she not only was a good leader, but she went way above board, way above and beyond to help the people that came through. And their example was that a woman came there with three children, and she didn't have her high school diploma, and Gail said, "There's no reason that you can't get your GED." And the woman did. And then after that, Gail said, "I don't see why you don't go on to college. You're bright and you can handle it." And the woman did. And when this nomination was sent to us, that woman was getting her PhD at the University of New Mexico. So I thought, well, if there's one out there, there must be hundreds. So we started WISP, which is Women's Independence Scholarship Program. And we have a wonderful staff of three that do this out of Wilmington. And so far, they have produced over 1,000 women who have graduated from the college or school of their choice. And we do not just give them scholarship money. We give them a car, someone to change the locks on the doors, attorneys, doctors, whatever it takes to get them through. My aim is to have every single one of them make it. And we've had a fantastic return on that investment. I was telling the other group that I got a letter from somebody. I get all the letters they write, and they're magnificent. Someday they've got to be put together, because they're inspiring to see what you can do if your aim is to give people a head start, get going, change their lives, maybe the first chance they've ever had in their life to get ahead. But anyhow, she has just graduated from the Wharton School of Finance. How about that? I mean, that's a woman who was, you could have put under the door, slip her under the door. She had no self-confidence, no self-worth. She'd been told over and over and over that nobody cared about her, they never would, and she was worthless. And then I'll throw in another woman who wrote, and her husband, she had four children, she was 28, and this was our first applicant for WISP. And her husband, when he went to work every day, he took the telephone and her shoes. Women in that position sometimes are criticized for not leaving. You have to understand they're hostages. And if you have four children and you have no way of making a living, you stay put. So we thought we were onto something big, and we are. We're just changing those lives dramatically. We now have little scholarships for their children. And we're now giving scholarships to people who work in the field so that they're more valuable. They know more, whether it's finance or whatever it may be. Most of them went in it because they suffered from it, but they weren't professionals, and now they're becoming professionals. So that's and I did endow that with $30 million 2 years ago, because I didn't want anything to disturb the work should I be, as Mitty says, called home. So so those were our beginning gestures in that field. Now, one of our sunbeams, a student at Mercy College in New York, wrote, and they're given the chance to give away $10,000 a year if they write a one-page proposal, and they've done their work, and it sounds reasonable. So they needed some money for a course Mercy was putting on at Sing Sing. There is a point to the story, and I am going somewhere with this. I just want to, it may go like this, but we'll get there. Anyhow, so I went up to Sing Sing. They invited me as a result of that to come to graduation at Sing Sing, graduation from college, held there on the premises. And I'm a very pragmatic, feet on the ground, corn husker person. And so I don't get carried away by anything new age, but I was astounded at what I experienced that night. It was truly redemption. These men had gotten their college degrees, and they stood up and they told their stories. There was no self-pity, no evading what they'd done and all of that, and just their families in the audience. And when one man said, I came here from Haiti when I was 19, and it took me 9 years and 3 tries to get a GED, and now I'm getting a degree. And he said, that's redemption for me. And I heard him, and I believed it. And then another one stood up at a later time and held up his diploma and gestured toward the woman who happened to be sitting next to me. I fortunately had come with plenty of Kleenex. And he said, Mom, I never did anything to make you proud of me. This one's for you. And there isn't a dry eye. Now, that isn't just pretty talk and keeping them busy and out of trouble. The fact is that the national recidivism rate across the country is 67%, and that's within a very short period of time. They're back in the system. At Sing Sing, there may be more now, but the last figure I got was 49 men who got their degrees while they were in prison and served their time, and they're out, and let's just guess what the recidivism rate is. It's zero. That's a phenomenal thing. Just phenomenal. So after seeing that and experiencing that, I just came right up here to Maine and waltzed over to the prison and maximum security, of course, and proposed that we have such a thing go on here. And they spent a year doing the right thing, evaluating everybody. Had they had some college? Were they smart enough to do it? Could they handle it and all that? And they came up with 21 men. Minnie and I went to see them, meet them. I always do that. It was really something because not a face moved a single muscle. And it was just looking at stone men. And it was hard to get it going. And I was using everything I had at my meager repertoire, very little on prison humor. But then I turned the man to my left and I said, who is your hero? And he said, what did he say? No, it was the great psychologist, Mitty. Freud's Jung, Carl Jung. And I go, ooh. And then we went around the table. It was just absolutely fascinating who these people described as their heroes. And so I gave them, we have a little blue book, tells what we do, and I handed that out, and we left. And about 3 weeks later, I came back, and school had started. So I walked up the aisle, turned around, and all of them, but one, was smiling. So I'd cracked the thing, you know, and that was very important. You have to know what prisoners are like, and we have learned. And I also had with me Viktor Frankl's book, Man's Search for Meaning, which I thought was a great book, especially for people who are incarcerated. And then David McCullough, who's my buddy and my partner in a school we run at Montpelier to teach American history teachers how to teach American history. And that's fun. And he had autographed the hardbound volume of 1776. So I handed out these books, and, of course, they were overjoyed and thrilled. And so that's how it started there. And I go and visit them every year, and they write me letters. One of the men, who's the smartest man in the prison, and the one they were worried about the most because he had great leadership quality, and he's never going to get out. He committed a crime when he's 17. And he had wrote me a letter not so long ago, and he said, I have found a way to use my time and be a good citizen. I can see a real calling for me in this prison. I'm going to run programs on GED or whatever it is. So, of course, the wardens love it because it changes the atmosphere and the culture in the prison. And they're sitting around a table with their heads down, and you think they're planning a mutiny or something. They're actually just comparing homework. So the only question they ever ask me, they say, you aren't going to stop doing this, are you? And I assure them I'm not. So then from there, we went on to Walla Walla, Washington. We only do it there because I love to say it. It's fun to say Walla Walla. You don't get a chance to say that very often. And so we have a prison at Walla Walla, Washington, and then we're helping at San Quentin, and four of them in Virginia, and one Mitty's working on one that's coming out of Princeton, which, you know, you want to get a good college. Then Cornell came along, and they're doing one at the oldest operating prison in the country. And I hear from prisoners, and none of them has proposed to me. And I don't expect they will, and that isn't what we're into this. Nor can I change their grade from C to A or something like that. So it's really just a human contact. Now, I won't go on and on about this, but the point is there is redemption in prisons, and it comes through education. And I mean, they all want to be in the classes. But here's the point. I was touring Sing Sing, such a thing, it sounds ludicrous to say that, with the superintendent, and he's now, Brian Fisher is his name, and he's now head of all corrections in the state of New York, and that was certainly a wise choice. He's absolutely marvelous. We were just passing an archway that led down this, and that was what we, all people my age, know as the last mile. They don't use the electric chair anymore, but he was talking about the population, and he said, well, there are people down there that are never going to get out of prison because they would just be a horrible danger to the populace. And he said, but of all the 2,500 men in this prison, every one of them had a miserable childhood. That I heard that. And then he said, and then, of course, they get involved in gangs, and then it's drugs, and then they're sent to prison. So I thought about that, and I thought, well, here we are, and we're educating them in prison over at this end, and we're doing all these other educational things in between, which I haven't even discussed. Why don't we start earlier, before the miserable childhood is that's the predictor. So my niece, Susie Buffett, had started doing this EduCare. So I went to see the school and talked to their board. And somewhere today, they were talking about something that someone had done that was wonderful governmentally for this EduCare. But I can top that. In Nebraska, they sent someone down to the unicameral. We just have one house. And they were proposing some kind of funding. And those 100 legislators, most of them from farm country, they voted to change the constitution of the state of Nebraska in order to make that work. Now, you know how phenomenal that is. So they have a thriving one, and you will see it. It's going to be here before very long. It's the fastest one to grow, to be built in the nation. And I'm grateful to Mrs. Baldacci for that and everybody who's contributed, of course, and the people who figured out how to run it. And they're all here tonight, and they're great, and I want to hug them all. So I think we're covering it at both ends. Preferably, you know, it'd be much better if we got everybody off to a good start, if we got them up to normal, average. Otherwise, they're not going to, by the time they're five, their brains don't, if their frontal lobes aren't average, and their mentality and their back, and they know the crayon colors, they know what a camel looks like and things like that, they're not going to make it. That's the science of the thing. This is not some whimsical thing. The science has been going on for about 22 years now. So I'm just thrilled that we can do this in Maine. First of all, I love Maine. My great-grandmother came from Maine, Portsmouth, is a better thing. So I feel a kinship. I like the people here because they do what they say they're going to do, and they do take care of each other, and you have real community up here. You don't know how terrible it is to live in a place where there's no community. Nothing happens. And the poor and the disabled and the mentally challenged and the mentally mixed up and whatever else, they just don't get any help because nobody cares. They just dig a hole in the sand and stick their heads in and keep it there. So it's thrilling to see this. For me personally, to see it take off so fast, you're going to see a big difference, and it's going to be such a beacon of light that other states will pick on it too. There are, I think there's 16 now in the country. They take a big investment. Think of it, though. It's to put a man in prison costs as much as sending him to Harvard every year. When they come out and they can do something and they can start paying taxes and they're law-abiding and nobody gets killed or maimed, there's no better investment. I look at everything as an investment. I don't do SOBs. That's symphony, opera, and ballet. Because they have their own constituency. Wonderful. Mine is trying to save the country or save lives, and I find this is the best way to do it. And we've tried different things. We're also fiendish about getting the payoff, not the payoff, but the information we need so we can judge it. Is it working or not? And don't give us any funny figures, you know. And so we have programs in the high schools in Fredericksburg and Spotsylvania County and so on. We also have the highest teenage pregnancy rate in the state. And we also have gangs moving in, either down or up, Richmond up, Washington down, and everybody's just looking the other way. And those kids are growing up miserable, absolutely miserable. One of the girls on our board is, she's a nurse by training, but she's a mentor in her heart, and she has mentored more kids than I care to count, spent countless hours with them, and she's had some successes and some failures. But I do remember one where a boy came up to her in the high school and said, would you be my mentor? And she said, well, let's go talk to your mother and see how that goes. So she went to the house and went into the kitchen where the mother was and said, what grade is Alonzo in? And the woman said, I don't know. You'll have to ask him. And that's not unusual. They don't say in Fredericksburg, where do you live? They say, where do you stay? Now, we have just given a house in Fredericksburg. Actually, we bought this wonderful house for women getting out of prison because that's the most crucial time of all is when somebody comes out of prison. They have nothing but $10 and no ID, and it's very hard to stay on the straight and narrow when you're operating under those handicaps. So we bought this swell house and turned it over to a group, and they did not have any local support for it. So it failed in a year's time. And we have just turned it over to the social services for kids who really can't be at home. It's not they're going to live there forever, but there was another case in our high school where a freshman tried to commit suicide, and the school went out looking for her, and they found her in a culvert and took her to the hospital and called her mother. And when her mother walked in the door, she said, I wish you had died. So obviously going home is not an option for somebody like that. So we're doing what we can in that area because we have this great house, and we hope it'll help a few. But kids in school right now, I always forget the numbers, but it's similar to this. The dropout rate is one every 6 seconds or 6 minutes, but it's no more than that. Now, what are we going to do with a nation full of kids who've never had any education? What are they going to do? You have to be valuable somewhere to get a job and keep it. And if they don't know what to do, I'll tell you what they do. They join gangs because they've had a miserable childhood. They didn't fit anywhere. They didn't belong to anybody. Nobody said their prayers. I mean, they didn't feed them. So at the age of 10 to 12 or somewhere in there, somebody comes along and says, you ought to be a member of our gang. And they do it because they belong. Finally, they belong. So we've got to get to them early to prevent it. I think personally, for every person in this room that has children or grandchildren, the best legacy you can leave them is to see that we start bringing up kids. And sure, it's not the way it used to be. No, there are no black grandmas. The grandmas are usually doing cocaine in the town I live in. And they have no knowledge of, oh, money. My gosh, I can't tell you how bad that is. And but they do have the babies. And the school system, I'm so mad at them. I just thought about this. The football team, of course, is everything. And they swagger down the halls, and that's okay, except they can get straight Fs and still be on the football team. I think that's the cruelest thing I've ever heard. The kid is feeling like $1 million, always going to go to the NFL. And our team was tops in Virginia, James Monroe High School. And that was in the paper, and everybody's going very excited about it. The next week, it listed the players from the state who had been picked up by colleges, not one from Fredericksburg. The reason being that their grades were so low that they couldn't take them on. So you get the kid all prepped, thinking he's going to be a hot star, Of course, he has to go to college first. And he's washed up at 18. So I've been making a little noise about that. But we've got to rethink the whole thing, is my thought. And grown-ups have to start running the show and putting in their 2 cents worth and really lobbying for these kids and the best practices. So I guess what I'm trying to say to you is I think education is absolutely number one. I'll leave the politicians to do the rest of the stuff. And I could be telling you about dozens of other things we're doing, but all of them have the same point, to give people a hand up, not, as he said, not a handout, but a hand up. We always ask for collaboration. When we look at a group, we like to see what their balance sheet is. We like to see what their executive officer is paid. And we're horrified when we see the board of directors is paid, which does happen. We think it should be ethical. It should be way above that, that they're serving from the heart. They don't have to starve. I'm not talking about that. But I've looked up some, and I am really appalled. So when I go to these classes, learning by giving, that's what I talk to them about. And they really respond. I'm going to tell you one thing about these living for giving, giving for a living, whatever it is. Anyhow, learning by giving. We had a boy at Mary Washington, a little Japanese boy, just a very short little boy. And he had the fervor. And so we backed him. And he's been in Honduras now about 4 years. And they've created a school, and they're building a village. And he's really in it, you know, up to his ears, and doing wonderful things. And then a girl from Cornell wrote to me, and she had a plan for New Orleans. And we backed her. If you get them early, and they're still full of a lot of faith, hope, charity, and visionary and all that, it really pays to give them a boost when they need it, because they're going to go on and do good things. And that's my legacy. And I'm very comfortable with that legacy, and I'm very grateful that I have the chance to do it. There's a place for everybody. I have a lot of money. Actually, we've given $100 million. And we haven't run dry yet. So we'll diligently be looking for more ways to accomplish our aim, which is educating youth. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine here on MPBN Radio. Today's speaker was Doris Buffett, elder sister of investor Warren Buffett and founder of the Sunshine Lady Foundation. She spoke at Colby College's recent nonprofit leadership conference. You may order an audio copy of today's Speaking in Maine program by calling MPBN's Audience Services Department 1-800-884-1717. The program is available online, either on demand or as a podcast at mpbn.net. You'll also find an archive of many past Speaking in Maine programs. That's at mpbn.net. I'm Barry Darling. Thanks for listening.